Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I am Deidre Tyler. Today we'll be talking with Jeffrey J. Matthews, author of Colin Power, Imperfect Patriot. How are you doing today?
Doing great, Dr. Tyler. Thank you for asking me on the show.
Thank you. I wonder if you could start by telling the audience a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Absolutely. I think I would have to start with my parents. My dad was a farm boy from Kansas who joined the Army right out of high school in 1957. He eventually got stationed to Germany, where he met my mother, who's German, was born in Bavaria. So my childhood, I grew up traveling around Europe and across the United States in different places and going to all kinds of museums. And my mom is a big lover of history, and I think I kind of got the history gene from her. But when I went to college, originally as an undergraduate, I was more focused on getting a job. And so I actually was a student in business and finance and eventually got my MBA. And I spent my early career as a banker. But then I made a switch and a decision to go to school full time to get my PhD at the University of Kentucky in history, U.S. foreign policy specifically. And when I ended up going for my first teaching position, professor position at the University of Puget Sound, where I am now, I'm actually have a job in the School of Business and Leadership. And so my courses are largely focused on a combination of leadership and with a cross-section of history. And so when I was looking for my next book project years ago, I thought doing a biography of General Powell kind of fit my teaching, mirrored my teaching well in the sense of he was a leadership icon, certainly an important historical figure. So I could combine my interest in history and the military and leadership and tell General Powell's story.
Now, tell the audience your first encounter with General Colin Powell.
So I first reached out to his office in about 2014 to get access to his personal papers, which he had donated to the National Defense University in New Jersey. And I got permission indirectly from him. He approved of it, but it was his assistant that reached out to me with the approval. So I didn't meet him at that time. But about 3 years later, when I was approaching my first draft of the book, I had written a newspaper article for the Hill newspaper, which made a significant reference to General Powell about lessons that we can learn from his experience. But it also included a criticism of him. And I was really surprised a few days after the article was published, General Powell actually reached out to me and sent me an email on a Sunday night. And I wasn't quite sure it was him, but he complimented me on a previous book that I had written, but he also was criticizing my article that I had written in the newspaper. And rather than debate General Powell via email, I kind of maneuvered over a series of emails to get an interview. And 3 months later, so in June of 2017, he invited me to his house. And I was there for about 4 hours and discussing all the contents of the book from his childhood and to him becoming Secretary of State. And I have to say, it certainly was one of the highlights of my career. And General Powell in person is just like many of us viewed him on television, extremely smart, affable, funny, warm, just very warm person. And so it turned out just to be a great experience and a great help to me in terms of completing the book.
In chapter one, you talk about General Powell's immigrant parents. What did they want for their son?
Well, both of his parents immigrated from Jamaica not too long after World War I, so in the 1920s, kind of during the Harlem Renaissance, and they settled. But they came to America independently. They didn't know each other, and met once they were in the United States in Harlem, and they were working class people. She worked in the garment district in New York, and he worked in at a clothing store in kind of the shipping department, if you will. But Powell, I think, is right that kind of this West Indian culture, if you will, that they brought with them included like an emphasis on education, an emphasis on work ethic, and ambition in the best sort of the word, and an emphasis on family. And being respectful and obedient. And so that was kind of the environment that Powell grew up with. And living in the South Bronx is really where he grew up after the age of four. And so what they really wanted Powell and his sister, his older sister, was essentially to move up a station in life, to be more prosperous than they were. And they saw education as being fundamental to their kids' well-being, to join the middle class, essentially, I think, was their dream for their children.
Summer church camp. Tell us what happened at the St. Margaret's Episcopal Church.
Yes, it's interesting because Powell loved the church, and he loved all the kind of the pageantry of the church and kind of the hierarchy and the stability and the rules. But there was a few occasions where Powell, as a youngster, got into trouble. And one summer in upstate New York, he was at a church camp with some friends, and somehow they were able to acquire some beers. And the beers that they didn't drink, they hid. To their bad fortune, the priest at the camp discovered the beers and called all the kids out from the camp and demanded to know, right, whose beers these were. And of course, everybody was scared as all get out. But Powell stepped forward and he said it was his beer and that he was to blame. And other kids, his friends, then stepped out and said that they were to blame also. Well, of course, you might imagine Powell's parents were furious that he had essentially brought disrespect to the family and at a church event, no less. But they did find out that Powell was the one who confessed, if you will, to the crime. And I think they really respected his honesty and essentially his courage for being able to speak up. And so I think because in the end he did the right thing, he did not suffer any severe punishment. And for Powell, I think it was an early lesson about the importance of being honest, regardless of what the consequences might be.
You talk about his high school years. Was he active in sports? What type of high school life did he have?
It's pretty interesting because given where Powell ended up as this remarkable leader, that in high school, he was really just kind of seen as a very affable, nice young man with a lot of friends, but he was not like a star athlete by any means. He wasn't a great student. He wasn't a leader in student government to any significance. And so that was really, to me, kind of opened the question of this larger question for the book is how do I explain the arc of his career from someone who wasn't a great student or athlete? How does this person become this leadership icon in American history and even on an international stage? And so that was kind of a basis point of me trying to say, how did he transform himself from that young man to what we know him to be?
City College in Manhattan. What was his major? How did he find the ROTC?
Yeah, this is a pivotal time. Powell really didn't have personal ambition to go to college, but certainly, as we mentioned, his parents did. And the City College in Manhattan was basically free tuition. And so it was one of his few choices to go to college was there. And his mom especially wanted him to study engineering because she thought, of course, that would land him right a good job, attractive job. And Powell was amenable to go along with that until he started taking engineering courses, which he realized were soon kind of above his head academically. And so from that experience, Powell was kind of shopping for a new major, and he basically had heard that if he got a major in geology, that was one of the easiest majors on campus. And so he ended up, of all things, becoming a geology major and did graduate with a geology degree. But more importantly, in terms of influence on Powell's life, was he noticed young college men dressed in these kind of snappy army uniforms. And he was really kind of attracted at first by just the way that they looked. And they were people who were in the ROTC program at City College, an army program. And so he learned more, and he quickly realized kind of the camaraderie that those young men had amongst themselves. And again, someone who really likes hierarchy and kind of rules, that Powell felt, being away from home for the first time, that the ROTC program and all that came with it was kind of a new substitute family for him. And he felt less isolated once he joined ROTC. And he excelled in ROTC. He did not excel much outside of ROTC. He liked to say it was his straight A's that he would get in the ROTC program that elevated his GPA high enough so he could actually graduate. He would say, "I graduated from college by the skin of my teeth, thanks to the ROTC program." And in that program, he also then, of course, found his professional calling, that he wanted to be a soldier for as long as he could after he graduated.
The next chapter you label Dutiful Soldier, 1958 to 1969. What was his work ethic to move up the ranks?
So certainly Powell's work ethic, and again, I think it stems from his parents' example and their expectation, was an extremely hard-working young soldier. And we have to remember, too, that when Powell joins the Army in 1958, it's only 10 years after integration had been started by President Truman. And so even though integration had begun, it was still clear that there was significant racism that one might have to contend with in the Army. And so Powell was determined that he would be the best soldier he could, and to overcome any kind of discrimination or thoughts that he might be a lesser junior officer than his kind of white peers, his white colleagues. And so he proved himself over and over. And it's not to say that he didn't make some mistakes along the way, but he quickly overcame them, right, learning from them. And when he went to Germany for his first major assignment, one of the things that really surprised him was how welcoming the Germans were themselves, the German civilians were, to African-American soldiers. He described it as really kind of being a breath of freedom to be living in Germany in his first assignment. But he did very well there. And then when he came back to the States, he was stationed in Massachusetts for another assignment, again, did really well, benefited from some really good mentors, which is a theme of the book, that Powell had mentor after mentor or mentor in his career that really helped him along. And then I would say a turning point in his early career in the 60s was he spent 2 years in the Vietnam War. Now, when he went the first time in late 1962, he was part of President John F. Kennedy's kind of military advisory program. So we actually technically weren't in the war yet. But Powell, in his first tour, he actually served with South Vietnamese army units throughout the year. And did very well and was really eventually well-respected by his South Vietnamese superiors as well as his American superiors. And he actually ended up getting injured. He stepped his foot completely through a punji stick and had to be evacuated from the field. So when he ended up leaving Vietnam for his first tour, he was decorated with the Purple Heart and a Bronze Star and glowing commendations. And so he came back to the States for about 4 years, stationed mostly in Georgia at Fort Benning, where Powell was doing a lot of training, becoming an Army Ranger, attending an infantry school. He actually became a teacher at the infantry school when he finished as a student. From there, he actually got sent to Kansas. There's a military school that most Army officers go through called the Command and General Staff College. And Powell excelled there to an extraordinary degree. So out of a class of, say, 1,000 students, when Powell graduated from this military college, he was second in his class of 1,000 students. So he had really proven himself. So despite him not doing well in high school and or college, in the military, setting. He excelled extraordinarily and really began to really demonstrate, I think, his intellect. And after graduating then from Kansas, he was sent back to Vietnam in 1968, when the war was well on from the American perspective. And again, Powell excelled on the second tour in Vietnam. He was less in a combat situation most of the time, but there was an occasion where he proved heroic. He was in a helicopter with some other officers, including his superior general, and the helicopter crashed. And Powell, despite breaking his ankle, was able to rescue a few other people out of the helicopter before it exploded. So by the time that tour ended as well, Powell was doing extremely well by 1969-70. His record was almost impeccable. And so he was really seen as kind of an up-and-comer by that time.
Chapter 3, Follower and Commander. After he returned, tell us about his D.C. years.
Yes, and so when Powell was still in Vietnam for that last tour, he had learned about essentially a graduate school program that the military and the Army offered, particularly that they would pay for officers, certain officers, to go back to school in a civilian setting. So Powell ended up going to George Washington University, and over the course of a year plus earned his MBA. By then, he had been promoted to lieutenant colonel. Part of that program, he was got an internship, if you will, at the Pentagon. And then he also was encouraged by the Army to apply for something called the White House Fellows Program. And this is a very elite program that the White House sponsors of about 30 people who are seen to be amongst the best and the brightest of the particular generation. So Powell applied, and he got raving recommendation letters from former superiors who said what an outstanding young officer he was with immense potential. And so that experience just added to not only his intellectual development, but also in terms of starting really to see leadership in government outside the military perspective.
Let's talk about the OMB experience.
Yes. And so the Office of Management and Budget was actually part of Powell was assigned there as part of the White House Fellows Program. And it was there under civilian leaders that he really saw basically how bureaucratic skill was needed in Washington to navigate passing of legislation, getting funding from Congress to support the executive branch, and also the kind of maybe dirty skill set that some people use to manipulate the system. And so Powell used to say that this was kind of his master's degree program in kind of the realism of how Washington, D.C. works. And so he made new friends, again, more mentors who would prove influential to his career. But certainly because Powell will eventually spend an abundance of his career as a senior officer in the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., that OMB experience that he had as an intern, kind of, if you will, really proved to be valuable.
Korea. What type of battalion was he assigned to, and what were some of the problems, and how did he handle it?
Yeah, Powell was stationed as a battalion commander in South Korea, where the United States has a large occupation force ever since the end of the Korean War. In this era, say 1973, though, the Army was going through some severe problems. We were still kind of dealing with the draft Army, so it was not the all-volunteer Army. As we know from the late 1960s and early 1970s, race relations were really tense, and this was also included in the military. The military and the Army in particular had a severe drug abuse problem. And so retention rates in the military were low. It was difficult to recruit. And so Powell, in this really kind of his first major kind of leadership position when he gets stationed as a commander in South Korea, he's confronting a unit that has all kinds of problems that he needs to deal with. And so this is where Powell's reputation continues to grow, because he proves himself an extremely competent commander. And essentially by raising the standards, the expectations of what he expected out of his junior officers at that time, and then the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, if you will, that they needed to all kind of prove themselves. And then as a result, right, to pass on to lower ranking soldiers in terms of what they would tolerate, not tolerate. And over time, PAL's battalion became one of the best performing battalions, from one of the worst to the best, largely because he kind of set the example and set the tone, including his willingness to get rid of really bad performers as a way to inspire the good performers to work hard. So it turned out the South Korea assignment, PAL would say, was one of his happiest and most effective assignments.
You talk about one of his mentors, General Julius Becton Jr. What did you find there?
Yeah, this is interesting because for PAL, it was only kind of in this time period where he realized that there was this group of African-American officers who essentially were banding together to support each other, to provide mentorship and guidance about problems they might face in a largely predominantly white army. And one of the key figures kind of in this collective, which was called the Rocks, was General Julius Becton. And so Becton was always on the lookout. He was African-American to help promising junior and rising soldiers. And so when it came to thinking about PAL's next assignment in terms of the military education system, PAL was slated to go to what's known as the Army War College, which is a perfectly fine college, which a lot of promising Army officers go to. But there is seen as a superior college would be selected for the National War College, which takes the best of the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines. It's kind of the cream of the crop. And General Becton was part of the selection committee. And so he had PAL rerouted, not to go to the Army War College, but to go to the higher kind of the elite school, the National War College. And it's just one example of PAL's mentors kind of intervening on his behalf to help his career. And again, I think that's one of the themes of the books for readers is to always be on the lookout for mentors and how you can have many different mentors for different parts of your life. And certainly PAL was a beneficiary of that. And so PAL does get selected to the National War College and does well there as well.
The annual war game exercise in West Germany, what happened?
Yes. And so when PAL graduates from the National War College, he gets a brigade command position in Kentucky at Fort Campbell. And this is the 101st Airborne, kind of the famous airborne group coming out of World War I. And so most of the brigades were being selected from Fort Campbell to go to Germany to participate in these important war game exercises. But the brigade that PAL was given to be commander of was the worst performing unit at Fort Campbell. And so he was not invited with his command to go to Germany, which of course was extremely disappointing to PAL. But what PAL did, when I think is really telling of his leadership and the example that he sets, is he saw this as an opportunity to prove himself as a leader and for his brigade to prove themselves. And so while the war games were going on in Germany and PAL was left at home, he doubled down on his commitment to raise standards again and to have his men compete to get distinctions in performance while they were there alone in Fort Campbell. And he really raised the standards and the performance. And so when his bosses came back from Germany and they observed what PAL was doing with his kind of low performing brigade, actually turned them into the highest performing brigade by the end of his tour. And so for PAL, this was just another kind of feather in his cap, demonstrating his leadership skills, which then just led to more success from that point on.
Working with the Pentagon, did he want to return?
It was interesting because PAL really preferred being a soldier amongst soldiers, leading in the field, if you will, like in South Korea and at Fort Campbell in Kentucky. But he kept getting slotted by the Army to go back to the Pentagon, which, of course, is a more of a staff position, right, a bureaucratic position. And so while he appreciated the opportunities those provided him, it really made him most happy to be in the field. But essentially, PAL did what the Army wanted him to do. And so if they encouraged him to take a new assignment in Washington, he would do that. And of course, that would become more true the higher he got up in the Army.
New visions of the Army Task Force. Tell us about that leadership position.
Yeah, ultimately, when PAL becomes at a senior, more senior level in the military, He begins to think about how to reorganize, reconstitute the army. And this will become more important later in his career when he becomes chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because by then he can see that the Cold War is coming to an end. And so when he's at that position as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he decides, I need to downsize the military, because if the Cold War is ending, Congress will downsize the military by force, telling them what to do. So Powell saw this as an opportunity to be proactive. And so if we are going to downsize and change the nature of the military, let's change it the way he envisioned to confront future problems that the military might have to contend with outside of the Cold War. So I think it's a really good example of the importance of leaders taking the initiative, because Powell got a lot of resistance to wanting to make massive changes. But in the end, he ended up convincing the president and the Secretary of Defense that he was right in terms of the reorganization. So I think it's a good lesson, not only of taking the initiative, but having the persistence to overcome resistance and challenges that one might face when you're trying to lead change.
National Security Advisor to the President. How did he juggle this position?
Yeah, this is pretty interesting, because Powell, he will eventually become the National Security the Deputy National Security Advisor in the Reagan administration. But before he took that position, he was serving under Ronald Reagan's defense secretary, by the name of Caspar Weinberger. And by this time, Powell's a two-star general. And he works directly for Secretary Weinberger for three straight years as a two-star general, and is basically the secretary's right-hand man, if you will. And they were intimate, both professionally and personally. Powell saw basically the secretary as a second father figure, and often traveled with him and his wife and Powell's wife, Alma, as well. So they were really kind of joined at the hips, and there was no secrets between them, including government top secrets. And Powell was very successful during those 3 years. And it's something we could talk about more, but this is the time of the infamous Iran-Contra scandal, when the United States was illegally selling missiles to Iran, and Powell was involved in that process. But before that kind of scandal broke out, Powell had completed his 3 years and was assigned to Germany, and had been promoted to three stars. And while Powell was serving in Germany, the Iran-Contra scandal became public. And it's during this time where the Reagan administration was under severe pressure and trying to defend itself in this scandal that President Reagan asked General Powell to come back to the Pentagon, this time to serve as the deputy, meaning the number two national security advisor. And he wanted Powell's help to essentially clean up the mess that led to the Iran-Contra scandal, which, of course, Powell was part of. But he ended up proving very effective in helping to reorganize the National Security Agency to prevent it from having kind of these clandestine operations, whether it's the illegal sales of the arms to Iran or things we were doing in Nicaragua with the Contras. And so Powell was given a lot of credit for reorganizing that government agency. And as a part of that process, Powell was elevated then to become the National Security Advisor, who became Reagan's sixth and final National Security Advisor for a year, the last year of the Reagan's presidency, and is generally given very high marks for his performance there.
When we look at 1985, Weinberger and several others were charged with felonies because they lied to Congress. At age 53, how was Powell positioned to move into the higher level?
Yeah, it's interesting because this is a time when we have a change in presidency. So Reagan right last serves in 1988, and President George Bush, Bush the Elder, I like to call him, becomes president, who was Reagan's vice president. And so part of the new President Bush coming in, he needed a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he was very familiar and very friendly with General Powell, because Powell had worked at the White House for quite a while. But he thought Powell was a little too young to be the National Security Advisor. And it turns out that Dick Cheney, who is George W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney is the one who really argues for Powell, that despite his relative inexperience compared to other four-star generals, that Powell was the right man. And so President Bush accepts Dick Cheney's recommendation, and that's when Powell becomes chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I have to say, just in terms of Powell being an African-American leader, that Powell was the first deputy national security advisor to be African-American, the first national security advisor who was ever in that position. And then also then he's not only the first African-American chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but he's also the only ROTC graduate. Most of the other chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had gone to West Point, for example, for their undergraduate degrees. And so Powell was a true trailblazer in this sense. But we have to remember at the same time that this was going on successfully in Powell's career, the Iran-Contra scandal, including some convictions of people like Oliver North and Admiral Poindexter, that Powell was under scrutiny as well for his involvement. So the legal process is very slow. And so it's going on all this time that Powell was a three-star general and then a four-star general and as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The trials, if you say, and as you mentioned, his former boss, Defense Secretary Weinberger, was indicted on 5 felony charges for lying to Congress. And as I'd mentioned, Powell and that Weinberger were joined at the hip. And so there were serious questions that if Weinberger had broken the law, whether Powell had not broken the law at the same time. And so there was this big question of whether the trials were going to come. And as Weinberger's trial was coming closer and closer, and Powell was expected to be a key witness, is when President Bush pardons Secretary Weinberger. And so no trial actually happened, and therefore Powell did not have to give trial testimony.
Panama crisis. What experience did Powell gain from this? Lessons learned.
So looming large throughout Powell's story is the lessons and history of the Vietnam War. And so once the war was over, Powell was this, part of this large group of coming up military officers who essentially thought they want to avoid the problems, do not repeat the problems of the Vietnam War, was often referred to as the ghost of the Vietnam War. And so in Panama, when Powell is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, this is a time where we have General Noriega as the dictator there, and they had elections down in Panama. But there was corruption, of which Noriega essentially rigged the election in his favor. There were all kinds of problems with the drug trade and instability. And so President Bush decides to invade the country. And so Powell, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right, he is the primary military advisor to the president and the primary military advisor to the Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney. And so Powell has a firsthand look about helping to oversee the invasion and its operation. And Powell thought it confirmed what he and previously Secretary Weinberger would become known as the Powell Doctrine. And it's seen as an example of the Powell Doctrine, meaning that to avoid the troubles of Vietnam, that the president needed to determine that military action was needed because of a direct vital national interest, that he needed to set very clear and attainable objectives, and that the amount of force that the U.S. military should apply must be decisive, if not overwhelming. And so not a gradual buildup, if you will, but decisive from the outtake. And though while there were some problems and mistakes made in the war in Panama, Powell saw it as a general success and a general validation of the Weinberger / Powell doctrine about that this is the proper way of war fighting. And Powell at this time, Powell's not like a commander in the field, but he is on television regularly. So this is the first time that Powell really becomes a national figure because the American people are seeing him on news, the news every night, talking about progress in the war. And so he really kind of gets this this first grounding of knowledge, giving knowledge to the American people, but also the receptivity to seeing him as a trustful, commanding, confident person. And of course, this is only magnified later when President Bush decides to fight the first war in Iraq, where the Iraqi military had invaded Kuwait. And President Bush makes the decision that the United States is going to wage a war to get Iraqi troops out of Kuwait and restore Kuwaiti sovereignty. And Powell, again, is really important in terms of helping oversee the larger planning for the war. But again, he's not in the field like General Schwarzkopf fighting the battles. He remains in Washington as the primary advisor to the president and defense secretary. But again, he's on TV regularly talking about the progress of the war, and he really becomes a celebrity in many ways and well-liked by not just Democrats or Republicans, but also centrists. And so he's on his way to becoming the most trusted, the most popular kind of military figure since World War II.
The Clinton administration, what was General Powell's major issue there?
It's interesting because after Clinton beats George Bush for the presidency, and of course, he's a Democrat. And so Powell's career as a high-ranking officer has largely been under Republican administrations. His new boss coming in, Bill Clinton, during the campaign, Clinton had promised to end the military's policy against having homosexuals serve in the U.S. military. This was a very controversial issue back then, and a majority of people in the military, certainly the senior leadership, did not want to end the policy ban against homosexuals in the military because they thought it would cause all kinds of disruption within the ranks to have homosexuals serve in the military. But because the president, right, Powell's new boss, had promised it in a campaign before he was elected, Powell knew he was going to have to deal with this issue. He would call it a hot potato. And he tried to defer it as much as possible to give Clinton some more time to be president, have some legislative victories before tackling something so controversial. And in the end, Powell proposes a compromise to the president. Which leads to a policy that was known as don't ask, don't tell. And so the idea is the military would not be asking people if there were homosexuals, and people did not have to admit one way or another, and then they could successfully serve in the military. And so it was controversial in terms of being a compromise, but President Clinton supported the compromise. He thought politically it was the correct thing, pragmatic thing to do. And Powell got a lot of credit for kind of negotiating the compromise, but he also got criticized by a lot of Americans for the first time who disagreed with the compromise, that they thought that there should just be the ban against homosexual militia should have been just ended outright, not this compromise that he had led. So it was a really difficult time for him, but for many people, they saw it as effective leadership and service of the president.
Civilian years. Tell us about the retired General Powell and his best-selling book.
Yeah, so Powell serves for President Clinton for about 9 months. So he finished 4 years as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when he retires, he immediately has signed a very lucrative book contract to write his autobiography. I believe he was paid $6 million at the time, which is a lot more than that even today. And so by the time Powell was writing the book, and it came out about a year or so later, he went on a book tour, and I would compare it to what was known as Beatlemania when the Beatles came to the United States in 1964, because Powell was just mobbed by people going to these book signings that he would do. I think he had, in the end, 60 stops at different cities. There would be lines wrapped around the block to get in to have him sign a copy of his book. And he was doing all kinds of television shows, late night shows, news shows, and was really this unheralded celebrity. Nobody had seen really anything like it. And it was at that same time that Powell was thinking about possibly running for president.
After 6 weeks and thinking about running for president, he had a mentor, and the mentor told him not to run. Tell us about that mentor.
Yes, there was actually a couple of people close to Powell, including former members, people who had worked for him, just loyal personal friends. And for many of them, they thought that Powell had been really successful in his career often kind of as the number two person, right? And so even as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he was the advisor to the president. He was advisor to the defense secretary, that they never saw him at the top, because when you put yourself kind of at the top leadership, you're going to suffer a lot of criticisms from people. And they just didn't think temperamentally running for president and everything you would have to do as to run for president, all the backslapping you would have to do and the deal making you would have to do and the fundraising you would have to do. They didn't see it as a good fit for his temperament that way. And so Powell wrestled with it, the question of whether she should run or not. His son, for example, Michael, was an advocate of him running. And I think Powell wanted to be president. His wife didn't want him to run. She was raised in Alabama in the Deep South, what Powell would call the Old South. And she knew of the racism that still existed in the country. And she did fear that he would risk literal assassination by running for president, if not being president. And Powell really wrestled with it. The stress caused him some health issues. He lost 20 pounds over the course of 6 months. He said he would wake up one morning, I'm going to run. He would wake up the next morning, I shouldn't run. He would vacillate between the two. And in the end, he decided not to run. And I don't think it's because the reasons his wife didn't want him to run. I just really think politically, he didn't have kind of the fire in the belly that it would take to campaign. There was some concern whether was he even certain he could win the Republican nomination. He had decided he was a Republican more than a Democrat, and the stress of perhaps running for the presidency and losing was something that really Powell didn't want to consider.
So after that, he decides to become active with boards. Tell us about the Alliance for Youth, the nonprofit.
Yeah, you're right. He joined multiple boards, including Howard University. He joined the board there, the United Negro College Fund. He was a board member for 5 years there. And then he got involved and essentially became the CEO of an organization called America's Promise, which, as you said, was really a national network to help young people. And this, I think you can draw a straight line from Powell's childhood with his parents, where he saw education as being sacrosanct. And so how could he invest even his own money, but to raise money from other wealthy people, to invest in communities across the country, to provide for young, underprivileged kids, a safe environment, to promote their education success, to provide mentoring, to find internships, that this became a lifelong passion. And his wife, actually, Alma, eventually takes over as CEO of their nonprofit, of which he was committed to for years and years, and it's still going to this day. And so Powell, at this time in retirement as a civilian, basically spends his time balancing charitable work, community service, and basically being a leadership lecturer across the country, of which was very lucrative. He was extremely popular. And so corporations would pay large sums of money to have them come speak to their employees at conferences and things like that. And so it was really a good life for him in retirement.
7 years retired, January 21st, 2001. Tell us about him being confirmed to the Secretary of State. And based on your research, do you think he was frustrated?
Well, I think those kind of 7 years in retirement leading up to that point, I think Powell basically was getting a little restless. Doing kind of the same things over and over again. And he kind of wanted to get back in the game, if you will. Certainly, other presidents, including President Clinton, had tried to get him to come back into public service, to become Secretary of Defense, for example. But Powell had decided that if he was going to come back to government service, he actually didn't want to be Secretary of Defense. His preference would be to be Secretary of State. And so when George W. Bush, the son of President George Bush, when he won election against Al Gore and kind of the famous controversial election of 2000, Powell had actually given a couple speeches supporting Bush in the election. And there was just kind of this unwritten, undiscussed assumption that if George Bush became president in 2000, taking office in 2001, as you say, that Powell would get the position. And indeed, Powell was nominated to be Secretary of State. And I think he was very, very happy to be back into government service where he could exercise significant influence for the betterment of the country. And so it's ironic because at this time there's a reunion also with Dick Cheney. Right. And so Dick Cheney becomes the vice president under George W. Bush, where Powell had served with Dick Cheney within the previous Bush administration. So there was a bit of a reunion going on there. But Powell certainly was very happy in his new role.
Tell us about the most disastrous intelligence failure in American history.
Yeah. So, of course, one of the things that when people ask me was Powell an effective Secretary of State, a good Secretary of State, I have to just say, I think the record is complicated and it's a mixture that there are very good things you can point to. For example, his leadership of the State Department, some 40,000 employees, right, scattered around worldwide. He really was a transforming leader for those people and the department as a whole, upgrading, for example, their facilities, upgrading their technology, increasing staffing, really did a remarkable job that way. And he also had some big successes in global health issues. But as you say, the biggest thing that looms as Powell Secretary of State was the decision to invade Iraq, right? The second war in Iraq, and that it was based on just horrible intelligence. And Powell is known for giving this speech a month before the invasion, internationally televised to the United Nations National Security. And Powell makes the case for war, that he is really, in terms of kind of giving these categorical certainties that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, whether they're chemical or biological, on the verge of having nuclear weapons, having close connections with terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. Because we have to remember this is after 9/11. And so there is some great fear about weapons of mass destruction and how they might be used, especially by terrorists. Mm-hmm. And so Powell gives this speech of which he essentially says there's no doubt that there are weapons of mass destruction. There's no doubt this is an imminent threat, meaning there's no doubt that we have to invade the country. Well, of course, we find out subsequently that there were no weapons of mass destruction and that Powell's speech essentially was all wrong. And so as a biographer trying to understand how Powell could have given such a speech that really kind of was influential in many ways, and it influenced me personally at the time, that I don't believe that Powell was being dishonest, as some people have suggested. So I don't see it as Powell didn't think they had weapons of mass destruction. I believe Powell actually believed that there were weapons of mass destruction and that he saw that the war was legitimate. The problem was when he and his staff were putting the speech together with the CIA, I think Powell suffered not from really an ethical lapse, but what I argue is more of an intellectual lapse, that he suffered from what psychologists call confirmation bias. And so I think because Powell was certain there were weapons of mass destruction, when he was looking at the intelligence data, he was locking in only to the pieces of evidence that supported his views, that confirmed his views. So the parts of evidence that raised questions about his view, he discarded those because he believed something already to be true. And when you believe something to be true, you're not open to countervailing facts. And so I think that is what in the end got Powell into trouble, was his mistaken beliefs about weapons of mass destruction. And Powell knew for the rest of his life, including when I spoke with him, that this would be the biggest blot on his record, he would say, or the biggest stain, he would say, on his record. And certainly it is true that way. But I think the story of Powell giving the speech is perhaps more complicated than the conventional wisdom often likes to point out.
What do you want the reader to gain from your book once they finish reading it?
I would say two primary threads. The first is I talk a lot about Powell as being a subordinate. When we started earlier talking about how did this kid from a working class, right, immigrant neighborhood who wasn't great at school along the way, how does he become the most trusted right, most respected military political figure of the post-Cold War era, that's huge arc. That a big part of understanding that is the conventional wisdom, I think, would be that he was such a great leader. And certainly he displayed excellent leadership in the military, especially at kind of the lower levels, like in Fort Campbell or in South Korea. But I really argue that Powell, for the most part, rose as fast as he did to such prominence was because he was an excellent subordinate to very powerful people, both military leaders and political leaders. And those powerful leaders elevated Powell promotion after promotion after promotion. And so we always have to be thinking about most leaders are also followers of someone else. And so leaders are often toggling between, am I leading my people or am I supporting my boss? And Powell is just an excellent representation of the skills you need to become successful at both. And the second point I would hope leaders would come away with ties directly to the subtitle of the book, which is Imperfect Patriot. And I think it's the admission that we're all imperfect, right? Eve, I mentioned to General Powell in our interview, I said, even our greatest presidents, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, FDR, even as great as they were still flawed people. In their personal lives, they made mistakes. And as president, they had policies that were grievous errors. And that we should just be reminded, even someone as successful as Powell, even as we all might look at each other individually, we're all imperfect. But I think a big lesson is to learn from our mistakes that we make, all right, to amend from them, right, and to do better. And so I think Powell can help us think along those ways.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us the next project you'll be working on?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Tyler. My next book is coming out this September, and it's called Generals and Admirals, Criminals and Crooks. And this is a story, both historical and contemporary, about a small faction of our leaders in the military, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, the Air Force, who continually get into ethical or criminal problems. And so it's a book that's basically kind of alerting the country that we continue to suffer from some bad, seriously bad leadership at the highest ranks of the American military. Even though it's a small proportion of our generals and admirals, it's still a very real problem that I think most people don't know is out there. So it might cause a bit of controversy, and maybe in some sense, I'm hoping it will.
Thank you so much. We'll be looking forward to reading that book. And again, thank you so much, Professor Matthews, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Tyler. It's been a pleasure.